This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We're going to do this evening the connection between the Maftir and the Sedra itself, between Parshas Porah and between the Sedra. The Maftir was the concept of the Porah Aduma, the red heifer, which is a very difficult concept to understand. Chazal tell us that the only person who ever really understood it was Moshe Rabbeinu himself. Even Shlomo HaMelech, who was the wisest of all wise people, never understood it. The purpose of the Porah Aduma is, it's a method of being metaher people, of cleansing people, of purifying people who've come into contact with a dead body and need tahara. In most cases of tumah, in most cases of spiritual impurity, this impurity can be removed through by use of a mikveh. This is one case where use of a mikveh alone is not sufficient to remove the tumah, to remove the impurity caused by contact with a dead person. In addition to the mikveh, which one goes to on the seventh day, on the third day and the seventh day, one is sprinkled with the ashes of the Porah Aduma, of this red heifer. It's because we don't have a Porah Aduma today that we're not allowed to go onto the Temple Mount. You see there where one goes to the Kotel, and one sees people going through that little door on the top there, into the Har HaBayis itself. The reason we're not allowed to go in is because of Tumas HaMes, because we've all been in contact with dead bodies in one way or another, and one isn't allowed into the area of the Beis HaMikdash with this kind of tumah. That's the only thing that in fact that is affected by Tumas HaMes. Although Tumas HaMes is one of the most severe types of tumah that there is, although it's one of the most severe types of impurity that there is, nevertheless its only effect is that we can't come into contact with the Beis HaMikdash, with Korbonus, and so on. The difficulty is that there are indications in the Parsha that Porah Aduma is something like a chatos, it's something like a sin offering. The word vechit'oi is used, mein nido chatos hi, it's mein nido a chatos, and in fact the Gemara in Avodah Zorah refers to it as a chatos. Those of you who are learning Avodah Zorah will remember we in fact did the Gemara on Daf Kaf Gimel, where the Gemara says Shani Porah, a Porah is different to other Kodshei Bedek HaBayis. A Porah Aduma does not have the same degree of sanctity as a sacrifice. It's a lower degree of Hekdesh. But nevertheless it's different to other lower types of Hekdesh, and it, in some ways it has the din of a Korban Chatos. Why? The Chatos Kariyei Rachmona. Because the Torah calls it a Chatos. The Torah calls it a kind of a sin offering, which seems to imply some kind of guilt attached to coming into contact with a dead body. That there's some kind of kapora that's needed. If it was pure tahara, if it was just purification that was needed, then it would be sufficient to go to a mikveh. The fact that we need, in addition to a mikveh, we need this mechatos, this kind of sin water, whatever that means, which is a mixture of water and the ashes of the Porah Aduma, and the fact that the Gemara says that this Porah Aduma is begeder, it's a type of a korban chatos, it's a type of a sin offering, seems to indicate that one needs some kind of a kapora, one needs some kind of atonement after having come into contact with a dead body. What is the atonement that one needs? I'll put forward to you the idea now, and we'll see it develop as we go on. Really, if a close person dies, one should have a kiddush and shul on Shabbos. One should have a party, and one should celebrate. What's there to mourn about? His life is over, his problems are over, he's on his way to Gan Eden, he's in the hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam, he's going to have his eternal rest and eternal peace. Tzoras he won't have anymore, difficulties he won't have anymore, Averas he won't do anymore, Mitzvahs he's probably done throughout his life. What's there to cry and be upset about? But the essence of coming into contact with death is that one doesn't respond intellectually. Shlomo HaMelech in fact says, Tov lechet el beit havel. It's better to go to a mourning house than to go to a party.
And there's more of a simcha really when a person dies than when a person's born. A person's born, just think of all the Torahs he's coming up against. A person dies, it's all over. If one would analyze it very coldly, one would come to the conclusion that there's nothing terribly much to really mourn about. Yes, there are didim of avelus to show that the dead person is missed and so on and so forth. But basically it's not necessary to act quite as emotionally as we do. But death is one of those things that everybody reacts emotionally. It's a dramatic event to anybody who comes into contact with it, and something one can never get used to, and something one can never relate to coldly and analytically. It's always something very deep and something very personal, and something one takes very severely. And that, in a sense, is not right, to take it as severely as we do. Because we don't, by not taking it rationally, what we're really doing is we are reacting instead of acting. And the whole basis of Torah, as we're going to see tonight, is to act, not to react. And death is the one time when those who left behind, when the living, don't act, they react. In fact, the Gemara says well, we'll come to that a little bit later, to the Yerushalmi. And as a result of having put oneself into a situation, or as a result of having found oneself in a situation of reacting, not acting in a way that one has rationed and reasoned, and in a way where one wants to act, but being completely out of control and responding in a way one didn't think is the way one would respond, and not being able to do anything about it, as a result of that, one needs some kind of a kapora. Why the pora? Why pora aduma? So bring a sin offering, this or anything. Why a pora aduma? What's the idea here?
There seems to be a further aspect of kapora to the pora aduma, a further aspect of atonement to the red heifer, where Chazal say that the pora comes to be mechaper, comes to atone for the ego, for the golden calf. And Rashi brings a medrash where the medrash says, "Mashal leben shifcha shetinef paltin." If a king's maidservant's child dirtied the floor in the palace, Omru, they say, "Tovo imo v'tekaneh chatzoyo." Call the mother to clean up the mess. Kach tovei poro to chaper ala egel. In the same way, get the cow to come in and atone for the chait, for the sin of the golden calf.
This we have to understand carefully. But we see the connection now between the parsha, between the haftorah and the parsha. In the parsha, it just worked out that way this year. In the parsha, we read about the golden calf, and in the haftorah, we read about the pora aduma. And Rashi says the pora aduma, in addition to being a kapora as far as the individual's contact with death is concerned, is also a kapora for the egel hazar, for the calf. And the idea being that one asks the mother to clean up the mess of the child, which we'll explain in a moment. What we've got to analyze this evening is the connection between these two concepts. What is the connection between the two things for which the pora atones? It atones for the idolatry of the golden calf, and it atones for coming into contact with death. What's the connection between these two?
The concept of the pora as opposed to an egel.
Why then, according to Rashi, do we bring a cow and not a calf? Says Rashi, because if a child makes a mess, you get the mother to clean up the mess. What does that mean? Why do you get the mother to clean up the child's mess? Get the child to clean up his own mess. But it doesn't work like that, because if you get the child to clean up the mess, the child will make another mess somewhere else. That's how it doesn't help. If you get the mother to clean up the mess, the mother will jolly well see to it that the child doesn't make the mess somewhere else. Because why did the child make a mess on the floor in the palace? Because the child is badly brought up. So what's the cause of the mess? The child? No, the cause of the mess is the mother. So treat the cause and not the symptom. The child is the symptom. It's not my business to educate other people's children. It's my business to educate other people's children's parents. That's what it is, because they are the cause of how the children are going to grow up. A parent has responsibility to his children. But if one's talking about solving a problem that one finds in a child where the problem is caused by bad upbringing, that has to be solved with the parent, not with the child. It doesn't help telling the child what to do. And so here we're talking about the egel. The thought, the concept which the Torah wants to show is that when you do tshuva, when you want to atone for something, and this is unfortunately something which is so often misunderstood or not understood, and that is if there's an avera that one's done. I'm not talking about where one just did an odd avera. That's one kind of avera, but there's another kind of avera which one finds oneself constantly doing. One might not be as honest as one should be. One might find that one's wasting a lot of time. one might, which is a terrible avera, by the way, a very serious avera, to waste time. Doesn't mean that one must always be doing serious things, but everything one's doing must be for a purpose. It must be worked out, that you're not messing around and just wasting time. It's a terribly serious avera. Or one finds that one talks in a way which is not nice. One finds that one says Lashon Hara. Whatever it is. One finds that one can't settle down to learn. One finds that one doesn't relate to one's husband or to one's wife correctly, or to one's children or to one's parents correctly. It doesn't help forcing oneself to start doing the thing right, because there's a reason why you're doing it incorrectly. We sang at the Shalosh Shudas, Leiv Tohor Boro Eli Elokim. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave me a pure heart. So why aren't I doing pure things? Because something's gone wrong with the heart. So it doesn't help just to correct the outside thing and say, from today I won't talk Lashon Hara. You will talk Lashon Hara. You'll carry on. And tomorrow you're going to say the same thing. Oh, yo, I talked Lashon Hara. From today I'm not going to talk Lashon Hara. And we know how it goes. Week after week and month after month. And every Yom Kippur we stand there making the same undertakings we took the year before. And every evening, if one does a bit of tshuva in the evening, you'll end up making the same undertakings as you did the evening before, and letting yourself down the next day the same way as you let yourself down yesterday, and you start getting depressed and miserable, and either you become neurotic, as we discussed at the Shalosh Shudas this afternoon, or you leave it all together and you just become an ordinary guy that gets into the normal habits and doesn't worry about whatever he does in any event. But there's no way that that kind of attitude to one's performance can lead to growth. The only attitude that to one's performance that can lead to growth is diagnosis. And that's really what Musa is all about, and people just don't understand it. People think that Musa is, I mustn't speak Lashon Hara, and if I say that enough times every day, and I frighten myself to death about the consequences of talking Lashon Hara, then maybe I'll stop talking Lashon Hara. That's what people think Musa is. That's not Musa. Musa is diagnosis. You talk Lashon Hara, find out why. What is it? What's the problem? What is Lashon Hara? What makes a person talk Lashon Hara? What's wrong with a person who constantly talks Lashon Hara? What's his problem? Find out the cause of the problem and correct the cause. That's what Musar is. Not just correct the outside thing. I constantly find that I'm not learning properly. I learn halfway. This is the standard problem which we all have got. It's a standard problem of Western society. We don't take things to their end. We hear a shiur, we go over it once or twice, and we semi-understand it, and we go on to the next thing. We learn a piece of Gemara, and we sort of understand it, and we go on to the next piece of Gemara. You read a Rashi, and you don't quite know what he says, but you think you almost know what he says, and you go on to the next Rashi. You've learned something, you've got a few questions, you can't quite formulate what the questions are, but you know more or less, and you go on to the next thing. And we do it with our work, and we do it with our learning, and we do it with everything that happens to us. Nothing is crystallized, nothing is clear. We don't aim for absolute clarity. We're satisfied with leaving things as they are. So it doesn't help saying, from tomorrow I'm turning a new leaf. From tomorrow it's going to be okay. From tomorrow everything I learn I'm going to know absolutely clearly. Every article in the newspaper I read I'm going to be able to summarize in my own mind and succinctly be able to put across to anybody else. Nothing's going to be confused in my mind anymore. It doesn't help, because tomorrow you'll do the same thing. You've got to find out what is the cause of being satisfied with confusion. What is the cause of being satisfied with mediocrity? And you've got to treat the cause, not treat the symptom. That's what we're told here. The egel, don't look at the egel. You're not going to solve the Jewish people's problems by working out what's wrong with the egel. Look at the cow. Look who gave birth at that egel. That's what you've got to look at, not at the egel. You've come into contact with death, and as a result of that, you've panicked. And you've reacted instead of acted. Don't say, next time I'll do it better. Next time I'll control myself more. That's not the problem. Look at the parah. Find out the cause and treat the cause and handle the cause. That's how you'll have growth. It's the same like medicine. If a person is ill and the doctors will just treat the symptoms, it's not going to cure. And if one's out for growth, if one's out to iron out the little inconsistencies in our character and to try and acquire new greatnesses and new heights in our character, we're not going to be able to do that unless we find the causes. What is it that we need in order to make us great? What bases do we need? And what do we have to eradicate? What roots are rotten that have to be uprooted before they can be treated? The Gemara in fact says in Avodah Zorah that the din is, in Avodah Zorah Daf Kaf Gimel, that the din is that Ha'oiker Avodah Zorah, if a person is being Mekayim the Mitzvah, if he's keeping the Mitzvah of uprooting Avodah Zorah, of destroying idolatry, tzorich l'sharesh achareha, You have to go and find the roots and dig out the roots. It's not sufficient to break it off at the top. It's not sufficient to take a tree and cut it off and say the Avodah Zorah is gone, or to break down a building. You've got to find out what caused the Avodah Zorah to be there in the first place and take out the cause of that Avodah Zorah. Otherwise it will always be there. And not only will it always be there, but it's worse. If you keep on cutting the surface off and you leave the roots, the roots flourish. And they grow and they grow and they grow. And each time you cut, as soon as it comes across up against the surface, you cut it off again and you cut off. Meanwhile, there's an army of roots waiting to sprout forth underneath. And one day they'll either get you when they'll overpower you. There'll be so much there that you won't be able to keep on cutting, or you'll be spending your whole day cutting. Alternatively, when you've got your back turned for one moment. So one can't force me this. One can't force oneself to stop being a so-and-so, and one can't force oneself to stop being a decent human being. One has to treat oneself. One has to find out the origins of one's problems. One has to find out the origins of one's potential greatness. And one has to treat those origins. And that's what Limud HaTorah is all about. Limud HaTorah is a study of the roots of actions. The actions and their roots. What makes things work. And the treatment of those things.
Still doesn't help. It helps us in structure. So we now understand that the purpose of a parah rather than an eagle, a cow rather than a calf, is to show us to go back to the source.
And we see that the parah now is mechaper for the eagle. But we've got to understand the connection between using the parah aduma to atone for reacting to a death situation and using the parah aduma for atoning for Avodah Zorah, for the Egel Hazar, for the golden calf. There are many connections in Chazal between death and Avodah Zorah. They're difficult to understand conceptually. The one is, the Gemara learns in Avodah Zorah also, Daf Mem Ches Amud Beis, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira Omer,
how do you know that something which has been brought as a sacrifice to idolatry can cause the same kind of tumor that a dead body can?
One of the strange things about a dead body is that it causes tumor in the whole building, not just by coming into direct contact with it, but even if one comes into the room into which the dead body is, one doesn't see or touch the dead body, one still is affected by the tumor.
The only other thing that does that as well is a sacrifice brought to Avodah Zorah, a sacrifice brought to idolatry.
And the Gemara proves that they're from various psukim connected with Tumas Hames from this parsha, that the same applies to Avodah Zorah. So you see halachically that the Gemara connects idolatry to Tumas Hames, to the problems of having come into close contact with a dead body. Furthermore, there's a Gemara at the beginning of Avodah Zorah, Daf Hey Amud Aleph, where the Gemara says, Tanya Rabbi Yossi Yomer, Rabbi Yossi says, Loi kiblu Yisrael es ha-Torah, the Jews only received the Torah ela kadei shelo yehe malach ha-moves sholet bohem, so that the angel of death should not have any power over them. That means after Kabbalah's ha-Torah, the angel of death had no power over the Jews.
Shenemar, as it says, Ani amati Elohim atem, I said you're like gods, uvnei elyon kulchem, and you're all so great. Chavaltem maaseichem, and then you destroyed your own deeds. Achen ka'odom temusun, and therefore you're going to die like any other human being. What was that destruction with? With the golden calf. In other words, were it not for the golden calf, the Jewish people reached such a level at Har Sinai that they would not have been subject to the hands of the Malach HaMoves, of the angel of death. So here again we see, although we don't yet understand, that some kind of connection between Avodah Zorah and death, not only a connection, but now we see a cause and effect, that death has been caused by Avodah Zorah. Avodah Zorah becomes the Porah, Avodah Zorah becomes the cow, if death is the eagle, if death is the calf. And it all started with the Avodah Zorah, with the idolatry of the golden calf. What is Kabbalas HaTorah? When we talk about receiving the Torah, what does that mean?
There's a beautiful Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Pei Ches Amud Beis, 88b.
V'amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, V'shah she'ola Moshe l'moram, when Moshe went up in today's Sedra,
Amru malachi ashoris lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The angel said to God, Ribbono shel Olam, mali yilud isha beinonu. What's a human being doing up here? Right, the angels sensed that Moshe Rabbeinu was coming right into their area of living, into their area of influence. And they said to Ribbono shel Olam, what's a human being doing here? Omahen lohen lekabel Torah bo. So God answered them, he's come to get the Torah. What's bothering you?
Amru lefanat chamuda genuza shegenuza loch tesha meot v'shivim v'arba doiris. This precious treasure, which you've hidden away for 974 generations, kodim shenivra ha'olam, before the world was created.
Whatever that means, we don't understand it. All we know that it means is that the Torah existed long before the world existed.
Atom avakesh litma lebos avodah.
Now you're going to go and give it to human beings, this thing that we've treasured for so many years.
So the Ribbono shel Olam Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe.
So God said to Moshe, Hachzeh lohen tshuva, Moshe, answer them. You give them the answer.
Amar lefanov, he said to him, Ribbono shel Olam, Misyarei ani shema yisrufuni behevel shebepiyim. I'm afraid that they'll burn me up with their words. They can destroy me. Amar lo echoes bekisei kavoidi. Hold on to my throne and answer them. If you're scared, you come here and hold on to my throne and tell them. Can you imagine the terror of Moshe? There he goes. He just went to fetch the Torah.
And then he finds himself in the middle of this whole argument between God and his angels. And the angels start attacking God, and God says, Moshe, you give them the answer.
Amar lefanov. So he said to him, Ribbono shel Olam, God, Torah sha'ata noseni, this Torah which you're going to give me, what's written in it? Anoichi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeisichol me'eretz Mitzrayim. You are the God. I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt.
Amar lahen. He turned to the angels, and he said, "LeMitzrayim yoradetim. Have any of you here been in Egypt that God took you out? That you sit and read this Torah? LeFaro hishtabtim. Did you ever have to work for Paro? Torah lama tehelachim. What do you need the Torah for? It's not talking to you."
Shuv ma'ktiv bo, and if you're not satisfied with that, what is the next thing that it says? Lo yilecho elokim achirim beinamim. Lo yilecho elokim achirim. There shall be no other God. You shall have no other God. Beinamim atem shurim she'ovdim avodas gilulim.
Are you affected by environments where there's avodah zorah that the Torah has to warn you angels not to serve idolatry? Shuv ma'ktiv, etc. And he goes on right through the Ten Commandments. He says to them, do you have to keep Shabbos? Do you have parents to honor? Are you jealous of other people? Are you involved in business? What's the Torah got to do with you? And the angels accepted it.
Kabbalah HaTorah means taking the Torah, which existed, don't forget, 974 generations before the creation of the world. It's not anything new. Right? It's older than the whole world. Taking the Torah, Kabbalah HaTorah means taking the Torah which was theoretical and making it practical.
That's what the act of Kabbalah HaTorah is. When the Jews accepted the Torah, what they did was they took the Torah, which was up till then theory, and they undertook to make it work. That's it. And by doing so, they believed that they could understand the Torah even better than the Malachi HaShores, even better than the angels could understand. And the fact is that the Medrash Tanchuma says on this week's Sedra, on the Parshas Parah, that when Moshe went up to heaven to fetch the Torah, he found the Ribbono shel Olam learning Parshas Parah. And what was he learning there? He was learning Rabbi Elazar's Shita in Parshas Parah. Learning Rabbi Elazar's Shita. There's the Ribbono shel Olam sitting there trying to figure out what Rabbi Elazar means. It's back to front, but it's not back to front. Because so to say, what the Midrash is trying to tell us is, ki b'yochel, Rabbi Elazar is capable of understanding God's Torah better than God is. So to say, in a sense. Because Rabbi Elazar has to live with it. Rabbi Elazar has to make it work. Rabbi Elazar sees its functioning and its aspects and facets of it, which none of the Malachi HaShores, none of the angels can see. And so to say, God and those around him, those in his Beis HaMidrash, are incapable of seeing. So the purpose of Kabbalah HaTorah is not just to get the Torah to learn. The purpose of Kabbalah HaTorah is to take the theory and to understand aspects of it which hitherto were not understood, because it was never practical, it was never put into practice, and to actually put it into practice. That's Kabbalah HaTorah. That requires intellect, really. Because what you have to do is you have to study the Torah, you've got to know what the Torah is. You've got to study the Bria, you've got to know what the world is, and you've got to match the two together. And that's the art of a Ben Torah. You've got to know your work, and you've got to know your raw material, and you've got to fit the two together. Imagine a doctor who's trying to diagnose and doesn't know his medicine. Imagine a doctor who's trying to diagnose and knows his medicine but doesn't know his patient. Can't work. For a doctor to diagnose, he's got to know his medicine, and he's got to know his patient, and he can put the two together. And he can't say, you know, we just do this kind of thing by feel, and it's all just in the heart, and it doesn't matter. Don't worry, everything will be okay. I'll have a l'chaim with you, and I'll tell you what's wrong with you. It's all okay. It's all emotional. It's not all emotional.
One has to understand clearly what the Torah is, how it functions, what the world is and how it functions, and the emotion, the simcha, and the joy of Torah is in seeing it work. That's when there's simcha.
When you do the mitzvah, when you take all the theory and you put it into practice and it works, that's when there's joy, that's when there's simcha. That's what Kabbalah Satorah is. What's Avodah Zorah? What did they do wrong? All the Mefoshim go out of their way to explain how what the Jews did with the Eger was not that bad.
They did, it wasn't meant as Avodah Zorah, and those who treated it as Avodah Zorah was just the Erev Rav, it was all the rabble around and about, it wasn't the Jews themselves, etc., etc. I'm not going to get into that at the moment. But what was wrong? Where did they go wrong? What was the problem? If one starts at the beginning of the parasha and tries to figure out where did they go wrong, then one sees it's very early on in the parasha. The parasha starts like this. Vayar ha'om ki boishesh Moshe loredes min ha'har. The people saw that Moshe was taking his time coming down. Chazal explained, because Moshe said before he went, I'm going for 40 days. And they figured that the first day he went up was counted as the first day. What they didn't realize was when he said 40 days, he meant 40 days and nights. 40 periods of 24 hours. So the time had come, it was 40 days since he'd gone up, and he wasn't down yet. In addition to that, says the Gemara in Shabbos Daf Pei Tes, that they started seeing images of Moshe lying down on his grave. They started imagining, the Sotan started bringing images to them that Moshe was dead. So what's the right thing to do? What would anybody do? You wait a few days. 40 days are up. Wait, maybe he's delayed. Maybe he hurt himself. Maybe he's on the way down. You wait another few days. Start looking. See, can you find him? And let's say you've waited another few days and he still hasn't come. What's the next thing to do? No? So you go to Aaron and you say, Aaron, what are we going to do now? Moshe is not here. It seems as if something's happened. What are we going to do? Let's see what they did. Vayikahel ha'om al Aharon. They demonstrated en masse around Aharon. There's panic. As you said, panic. Vayom ru'elov, and they say to him, Kum, get up. Asay long elokim, make for us a leader, asher yelchu lefanenu, will go before us. Kizeh Moshe ha'ish asher elenu me'eretz Mitzrayim, because this man Moshe, who took us out of Egypt, lo yodanu me'ayolanu, we don't know what's happened to him. Where is he? Oy, 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 what will happen to us? There's panic. That's where they went wrong. And that was the beginning of the Avodah Zorah. They meant well. They were worried. Who's going to teach us? Who's going to lead us? Aaron could easily have said, I'll appoint a follower, I'll appoint someone else. But we're told that Aaron was worried that if he did that, it would cause machlokes when Moshe came down. Let's say Aaron appointed Yoshua to be the next leader. When Moshe came down, there would be two camps, those who wanted Yoshua to stay and those who wanted Moshe to stay. And so Aaron didn't want to do it, so he decided rather to make something inanimate, which he was hoping would delay the whole thing in any case, and by the time they were finished, Moshe would be down. And even the inanimate thing he made was just to say, look, this symbolizes the leadership, but it's still Moshe and it's still the Ribbono Shel Olam, as Aaron in fact says further on. But that didn't help. From this point, it's a downhill slide. He says, take off your gold, and they take off the gold. They're panicking, they'll do anything. And the golden calf comes out and they say, this is what brought us out of Egypt. It's crazy. It's just not rational. But when people are panicking, they're not rational. What is it that caused the panic? The image of Moshe dead. It's death. When there's something as dramatic as death, people react. They don't act. Any situation where you're opposing the whole concept of Kabbalah Satorah.
Kabbalah Satorah is not that my behavior will be a reaction to what has happened. Kabbalah Satorah is I'll study what's happened, and my behavior will be an imposition of Torah on what's happened. I'll change what happened. I'll color what happened with Torah. It's not going to be, my actions are not going to be merely responses to what happened. I'm not in the hands of what's happening around and about me. I'm going to impose on what's happening around and about me. That's Kabbalah HaTorah. That's the concept we discussed this morning in the davening, to be mamlich the Ribbono Shel Olam, to make the Ribbono Shel Olam king over the world, over Oretz, not only Shamayim, but to bring God down from heaven, and to make him the king over the earth as well. That's what Yiddishkeit is about. That's what Kabbalah HaTorah is about. To take God and inject him into situations. That means our response to situations is not a response to the situation in terms of a reaction, but it's the injection of God into the situation to make the situation godly. And for that you can't panic. For that you can't be reacting. For that you must be acting in a predetermined, carefully worked out way.
And in fact, the din is that an oinen, a person who is directly in contact with a dead body, before the body is even buried, is potur min ha-mitzvah.
He doesn't have to do the mitzvahs. Normally the reason that's given is because he's torud b'mitzvah. He's occupied with a very important mitzvah at that time. He's attending to the needs of the body. But the Yerushalmi gives another reason, which ties in with what we're doing over here. And that is,
Omar Rabbi Bon. Rabbi Bon said, this is the Yerushalmi in the third parak of Brochus, in the first Mishnah. It says that you must remember the days of your going out of Egypt. That doesn't mean just going out of Egypt. That means Kabbalah HaTorah. The whole concept of coming out of Egypt and receiving the Torah, you must remember all the days of your life. Says Rabbi Bon, that doesn't mean all the days of your life. Obviously, you can only remember all the days of your life. You can't remember when you're dead. What it means is, Yomim She'at Oisek Bohen B'chayim. Days when you're occupied with living things. That's when you're chayav to remember the Kabbalah HaTorah. V'lo yomim sh'at oisek bohem b'meisim.
But not when you're busy with dead people. When you're busy with dead people, you have no chiyuv to remember and be responsible for the act of accepting the Torah. Because when you're involved with a situation of dead people, you're involved in a situation of reacting. You're involved in a situation of panicking. And there's no way that the whole concept of Kabbalah HaTorah can be given expression to in an atmosphere of panic. So you're potter. It doesn't apply to situations of panic. When you're panicking, the Torah doesn't apply to you. And that's why when you lose your temper, it's as if you're serving idolatry. Because when you're panicking as a result of death, it's mutter. The Torah makes permission, makes provision for that. That's human nature. But when you panic for any other reason, the Torah makes no provision whatever. If you're reacting for any other reason at all, that's begeder avodah zorah. Then you're coming onto the area of the golden calf. And that one has to understand that
one often finds oneself in situations where not only is the natural thing to react in a certain way, but one almost can't conceive of reacting in any other way. You know, to keep the Torah when it's all very easy is not a problem, and that's not what it's all about.
To stand in shul and to daven the davening which is in the siddur and say, look what a good fellow I am, I'm davening what's laid out in the Torah, that's Kabbalah HaTorah. You don't have to be a big gadol to do that. To sit and learn, the Torah of the Ribbono Shel Olam, to sit and learn Gemara and learn that which constitutes the Torah, and say, look, I'm not reacting, I'm doing what's required of me, that's all fine.
Where it requires greatness is in situations which demand reaction. And you're able not to do nothing.
To do nothing, just to kill yourself and just to be dumb and harsh to the situation and just not respond because you're insensitive to the situation. That also you don't have to be a godel for. You can be a block of wood for that. But what it requires is to be sensitive to the situation and to translate your input, to translate what you're receiving from the situation, not directly to a reaction, but what does the Torah require of me in such a situation? To understand the situation as it's happening, to analyze it, and to see what it really is.
Rashi says further down, and here we'll see how to do it. On the Poro Aduma, it says, V'sorat es ha-poro, you must burn the cow, k'shem she'nitzraf ha-egel, in the same way as the calf was burnt. Then he goes on to say, U'chashem, on the same way as the golden calf defiled anybody who came into contact with it, so does the cow defile anybody who comes into contact with it. I'll explain that part in a moment. And in the same way as they became pure through its ashes, here too, through the ashes they become pure.
What does that mean? How did Moshe, was Moshe mechaper? How did Moshe bring about the tshuva? You'll remember he ground all the golden calf up into fine powder, and he mixed it with water, and he made them all drink it. The porah adumah, we burn the porah, we mix it with water, and we sprinkle it over the people. There's a parallel.
And says Rashi, in the same way as tahara is affected in the case of the porah adumah by subjecting oneself to the ashes, to the dust of the porah adumah, the same applies to the golden calf.
What one has to do is simply realize
the consequences of the panic. Somebody says something to you which gets you into a temper.
And that's the classic situation of panic. Somebody says something to you which really gets you angry. And you're going to say something to them.
And if you analyze it afterwards, you'll find that your desire to say that thing to them was not because anything would be achieved by it, but just to let off steam. There's no other value in saying what you were going to say, just to depressurize yourself. That's all there could be. You want to swear, you want to wring their necks, you want to punch them, you want to shout back at them, whatever it is.
But it's not going to be constructive. There's not going to be more peace afterwards. He's not going to like you any better. The pressure will be released, that's all.
What is the release of pressure? And when the pressure is released, there's nothing. You take this golden calf, and you can grind it up, and what are you left with? Powder.
You can take this porah adumah and you can burn it up, and what are you left with? Ash. It's nothing. To understand that the making, what was the fruit of their panic in the case of the golden calf? Moshe they thought was dead, they panicked. What was the fruit, what was the result? An impotent, dead piece of gold that couldn't do a thing for them. It's not rational. They worried about having lost Moshe and they substitute Moshe with something completely useless. But that's what happens when you panic. That your reaction is one which results in something totally useless. It has no use whatever, it has no purpose. That's typical of a panic situation. It's typical of all Avodah Zorah. There's no way that idolatry can be rationally worked out. That a person can believe that the thing that he's bowing down to can have any force can't be rational. Idolatry is panic. You need something to grab hold of. You need something to believe in. You'll believe in anything. The same thing over here. They needed something. Moshe was gone. What now? They'll grab onto anything, but if you look at it coldly, it's so stupid. The thing that you're grabbing onto has no power. When one's confronted with a situation that creates a feeling of panic before acting, one has to simply look and see, what is it? What is it? Is it a poro? That if I burn, I'm left with a few pieces of ash? Is it an eagle? What are my reactions going to achieve? What am I going to achieve by my reactions? Am I going to have an impotent golden calf that can do nothing in any case? That's what one has to do.
And more particularly, the method of doing it is by grinding it down. Take the golden calf and grind it.
What does grinding it down mean? Release it, reduce it to its basic element. Don't look at it. You can look at the golden calf and it has a beautiful form and it can be very imposing. But be a bit cynical. We've talked before about how one must be careful not to be cynical. But I think I've mentioned to you many times that every middah that the Ribbono Shel Olam created, every characteristic, every human characteristic that God created, has a good use as well. We're not allowed to be cruel. But sometimes you've got to be cruel when a parent has to put his child over his knee and give him a jolly good thrashing. That's cruelty that he uses in order to be able to do that. And if the parent is unable to do that, there's something wrong with the parent. He's not balanced, he's not stable. But if a parent goes bashing his babies, that's also there's something wrong. The cruelty has to be balanced. One has to be miserly. One isn't allowed to be miserly. Depends when and how. One has to be miserly when one's going too far. One has to know how to control one's income to make sure that one isn't spending more than one's earning. That's a middah of miserliness. But one can't be miserly to the point where one's spending less than one's earning, just for the sake of hanging on. Cynicism, we've said, is one of these middahs which is terribly destructive. It's destructive to be cynical. One can reduce anything to nothing. You can take the Torah, you can take Moshe Rabbeinu, you can take the Vilna Gaon, you can take whoever you want to, and by a smile, a hardly detectable smile, you can reduce it to nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's the power of cynicism. So what's it given to us for? For the golden calf. Smile at it. When you see a golden calf, just see it for what it really is. It's dust. Gold dust, which you can mix with water and you can drink and it's gone, finished. Nothing left. That's what it really is. How does one do that if it's not a golden calf? If it's an emotional problem. It's all very well if there's a golden calf, you can say, just smile at it, see that it's nothing but dust. How do you do it if it's an emotional problem? Let's see what they did wrong, and then from that we'll understand what we're meant to do. They had an emotional problem. They thought Moshe was dead. And they panicked as a result of the emotional problem. What caused their emotional problem? A lack of understanding and a wild imagination. And in fact, one can reduce it to the first one only. It's because they made a mathematical miscalculation that the whole thing started. Because they didn't understand that when Moshe said he was going for 40 days, that meant 40 days and nights. Because of that, the first fear that came into their mind is maybe he's dead. And then they started imagining him dead. Everybody has this feeling. One has it as a child and one has it later on. If one's parents say they're going to be back at 10 o'clock and then 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, they're not back yet. Chas v'shalom, the first thing that crosses your mind is, I hope nothing's happened. Or one's wife, or one's husband, or one's children, whatever it is, if you're expecting them back. There isn't much of a tolerance level either. They said they're going to be back at 11. By 11:30, people are worried already. Be reasonable, be rational, half an hour, what's half an hour? Wait until 2 o'clock before you start getting worried. It doesn't work that way. People start getting worried immediately, as they did. Wait another day, maybe he'll be down. He said 40 days, and 40 days are up and he's not down. Maybe he's dead. And the moment you say maybe he's dead, you start seeing pictures and you start imagining all sorts of horrible things, and then you start relating to him as if he in fact really is dead, and then you start the panic. But where did it all start? The thing was built up because the basic premise was incorrect. When one's confronted with an emotional problem which arouses a panic reaction, which tends to make one want to react rather than to act, there's a very simple treatment. Analyze. Do to it what Moshe did to the golden calf. He ground it up into its little granules. He ground it up into its little pieces. And they saw that it was nothing but a collection of little pieces. It had no power. It was nothing. It was breakable. Break it up. This applies to anything. One can be learning a piece of Gemara. And I must assure you that if your initial reaction to a piece of Gemara is not one of panic, then you don't know what Gemara is. It's absolutely natural that you open your Gemara, if it's a new piece of Gemara, or a piece of Gemara that you haven't completely mastered, or an old piece of Gemara which you're trying to learn as if you've never seen it before, your first reaction must be panic. If you're sitting in an exam room, they hand out the papers and they tell you to turn them over, your first impression must be one of panic. I don't know anything. Where's it all? I didn't learn all this. That must be the first reaction. What's the second reaction? 1 second. Just take it easy. Count up to 10. And just let's take one thing at a time. Because the first thing you do is you look at all of them. The thing's just too big. One tends to bite off more than you can take. You look at a whole sugi of Gemara. You look at your whole exam paper. And you're trying in half a second to figure out how you're going to attack the whole thing. And you can't. It's impossible. So you panic. But you stop for a moment. And you forget about the rest of the paper. And you look at the first question. Question number 1A. And you read it. And your mind's blank. And you relax again, and you try again, and you read it word for word, carefully, question 1A. You put a piece of paper over the rest of the exam paper. You're not interested. There's just question 1A. And you find it simple. And question 1B and C, and then the panic's over, and you go on, and the exam gets done. You take your piece of Gemara, and you panic, and you stop, and you say, 1 second. I don't understand anything. I don't know what's going on. I don't have enough technical knowledge. I don't know the words. I can't translate. I've never heard of these things before. Where does it all come from? How am I ever going to make sense of it? You stop. And you start reading. And you'll see the first word you do know. And the second word you do know. And the third word you can find in a dictionary. And the fourth word even Rashi says he doesn't know. And the fifth word. And so you go on. And it's not that bad. And the sixth word and the tenth word. And you understand the Mishnah already. And you go over it a few times. And the next piece of Gemara. And you start. And one word, two words. It's easy. Just break it up. And on a more sophisticated level of learning, when you've got the whole sugya, when you know the Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, but you're confused with the concepts. So Rashi, and a Tosfos, and a Rambam, and a Rosh, and a Rif, and this one says that, and that one says this, and I'm lost. Just stop for a moment. Break it up. Who were the elements in the Gemara?